to Tufts for this honor to come and share with you. And also, thank you very much for the introduction, Professor Sakai. Very kind. I want to address to you with you today some ideas that might move us into, let's say, the more positive side of the peace concept. We conventionally, you know, when we talk about integral approaches to peace, we talk about negative peace and we talk about positive peace. I'm very interested in what this might mean, these concepts, where they come from, and I've been researching them for over 20 years now, both theoretically and in practical manners. And it seems to me that most of what we've been talking about so far is about negative peace issues. We've been talking about violence and conflicts, how we deal with them, how we get into them, how we get out of them. And we've heard case studies from all around the world, and we've tried to identify some common elements. But we don't seem to talk very much about the positive. And I wonder why that is. So I'd like to start, first of all, by sharing with you some of my own concerns and reflections and attempts to answer this question. It's not just in this room that we don't talk too much about this. It seems to be happening everywhere around the world. And not only in places where there are deeply entrenched and chronic conflict situations, even in places of relative stability and peacefulness, you don't seem to find that there are that many peoples where people are really happy and thriving. You know, I'm interested in the deep cultural dimensions of peace and the deep psychological, historical dimensions, particularly how we can untap the human potential. So could we go to the next slide, please, Steph? As you know, did you know that we are still in the UN decade of a culture of peace and nonviolence for the children of the world? Yes, did you know that? I don't see too many yeses here. Well, we are. Actually, it started in year 2001. It's a UN decade coordinated by UNESCO. It ends in 2010. 2005 was the midpoint of that decade. And for many intents and purposes, many people, particularly of civil society organizations, consider that this has been a failed policy action framework on the part of United Nations. We had two main reports in the year 2005, an official General Assembly report, which basically lists a series of actions taken by different UN organizations, and there's this one short page on non-governmental activities. There was an alternative report produced by the Foundation for Culture of Peace in Spain, which brings together the activities of about 700 organizations, civil societies, organizations around the world. And there's a very interesting, I'd say, paragraph in this report, which more or less identifies the situation as a whole. They say, why, if there had been a statement of true will amongst the nation states who are members of the UN, all of whom are committed to this campaign, is there this lack of reactions, means, and achievements? Next slide, please, Jay. So, let's assume that this is the case, that at least as far as the United Nations is concerned, talking about culture of peace will not get you very far. You know, if you want to make a career at United Nations at this time, don't go there and talk about cultures of peace. If you talk about security and other things like that, you might get further. Those of you who are, you know, thinking of careers in the United Nations. And my response, my basic hypothesis is that more or less around 2001 and the 7/11 and the beginning of the war on terrorism, that was just an event. What's been happening is that the security paradigm has overridden, let's say, the peace agenda. Getting back to this integral concept of peace idea, there's some interpretations that are very interesting about the historical roots of an integral peace concept. One could say that the negative peace component, the absence of direct violence, is basically similar in people's experience to security. You know, in the UN paradigm, it's the freedom from fear component of the Kofi Annan's policy. There's also the freedom from want. And so there's this other dimension of the positive peace, which seems to have its roots in actually more Eastern ways of thinking. The negative has its roots more in Western types of thinking, Pax Romana, so on and so forth. But the notion of harmonious living, of mutually harmonious relationships between humans, humans with themselves, and humans with a greater nature and community of life. This is more akin to Eastern ways of thinking, but and also the thinking of many indigenous peoples and cultures around the world. So there's some very interesting evidence now that's been coming out of evolutionary psychology. Evolutionary psychology is a subdiscipline in psychology that tries to understand how human behavior has been evolving from other species in our evolutionary history as we became humans, and what are the deep, you know, the deep behavioral dispositions that we seem to have. And in the last 20 years, there's been some very interesting findings that have been created. As you might know, the culture of peace paradigm of United Nations, which was developed in UNESCO, had its roots in the Seville Statement on Violence and the cultural hypothesis. The Seville Statement of Violence, 1983, basically stated that humans do not have tendencies to act violently. There's nothing inbuilt. Yet, as we all know, since that period of time, the reality shows that violence and conflict, violent conflict, is continued. It's very difficult once it begins to stop it, as several of our colleagues here have already expressed. So I think the record from evolutionary psychology is important to consider. Doesn't mean we are determined, but we do seem to have some deep evolutionary patterns, dispositions, if you like. And for most of human history and experience, we have lived in difficult, dangerous environments, and we are all, it seems, wired up in such a way where we can deal with threats and the fear, anger, aggressive response is one whole set of possibilities of action. And also there is what we can call predatory aggression. A lot of peace and conflict studies assumes more that aggression and violence comes from defensive motivations, but that's not always the case. There's also predatory types of aggression, and there's evidence from neurophysiology, contemporary studies, that we have separate neural pathways in our brains that mediate the emotional and action responses when we're threatened or when we are actually involved in predatory behavior. And I think one of the greatest challenges going into the question of today's symposium this morning, what are some of the root causes of conflict and violence in the world today, is that we really haven't come to terms with this side of our nature, of our human nature. It's very real. And I think we need also to question ourselves to what degree are the root causes have to do with the fact that there is a side of us that wants to accumulate resources. And I would even ask the question, is not, in a way, capitalism, globalized capitalism, a form of legitimized predatorial behavior? You know, as some societies within themselves and with relationship to other societies compete to control the resources and the products of human labor, you know, this concentration, this is a very deep way of living that is now present in all our lives. And we are involved also in the media depiction of violence. And do you ever ask yourself, why is it that people seem to find violent media, violent sports, somehow attraction, and they're willing to, you know, to pay for it? Is it that we've become so insensitized in our culture that we believe that the excitement that's associated with hunting behavior, with warrior behavior, is some sort of a joyful experience? You know, I think there's a basic literacy that needs to be taking place in education particularly, where the interdisciplinary field of what's called hedonics, which is the study of the different varieties of human emotional and affective states, both pleasant, positive, and negative, we need to really ask ourselves, I would say, next slide, what is the foundation of human happiness? What are the kinds of human happiness? I like very much this quote from the Dalai Lama, who says, "It's my belief that the lack of understanding about the true cause of happiness is the main reason why people inflict suffering on one another." Next slide, please. So I would say that in our world today, you know, there's a lot of work that's being done on the study of human happiness. There is a world survey, University of Michigan, on subjective well-being. There are some states, like Bhutan, Thailand is now beginning this, who are taking this very seriously and are developing policies addressing issues in terms of the state of happiness of people. You know, will it bring greater well-being to people? But the main point is that we have this one evolutionary tendency to deal with aggressive, menacing situations. But we also have this other evolutionary line, which enables us to pursue sociability, to seek fulfillment, to seek joyous harmony, and to flourish as human beings. And the neurophysiological studies seem to point that these are two relatively separate subsystems of what is called emotional motivational activation of our nervous system. For that reason, you can often go into find people who are living in very difficult life circumstances, yet they remain, you know, they create positive bonds, they have resilience. But also you find the opposite. You can find places or societies where there's peace from the negative peace point of view. There's stability, but you don't find people necessarily are healthy and happy, you know? And actually, there's a lot of research that's being done on advanced industrial societies which show that there are high rates of suicide, and that overall people do not seem to be very happy. When there's this loss of a sense of community, there's this loss of deep contact with nature, et cetera, et cetera. So I think we have to ask these very, very deep questions. Just to give you an example, in the 90s, I did a lot of work in the post-war culture of peace building, democracy building in Central America, in the Central American conflicts. And if you look at Central America now, in many of the countries, you will find more violence, of different kinds, of course, than you found during the civil wars that took place there in the 80s and 90s. The deep structural roots of that violence, of the violence of the 80s and 90s, has never really been resolved. Many guns, of course, remained in the hands of civilian populations. But basically, what's happened is that the security issues have, the policy has remained in the hands of the governments. The civil society is basically doesn't have the capacity to have influence substantially in defining what are public security issues. So you have phenomena such as the Maras, for example. So in the name of public security, the regimes, next slide please, Jeff. The regimes have created laws to basically make it illegal to wear tattoos. Maras are two very large youth gangs. They came out of the immigrant experience in Los Angeles. It started in El Salvador, but now they have spread out in Honduras and Guatemala. Each of these two gangs has about 100,000 members. We're also talking here about a generational problem. We're talking about a large cohort of young people, and given the types of economic policies that these countries have, they have not been offered, rewarding life opportunities for study, for education, for work. These are young people who had come from broken up homes, so they had found a family nurturance in the gang system. And you have now these two very large gangs that roam. They're migratory to some degree. They are now in all over the United States. They're even in Spain. And basically what the governments have done as a reaction is to militarize this problem and to enact very draconian measures. They will basically, these laws, put any young person who's tattooed into prison. Where, and once they're in prison, then they go into a whole other very risky sort of path. So I'm giving you the example of Central America as one example of how powerful the security paradigm is, and that achieving peace in terms of military resolution and in terms of even having democratic institutions does not guarantee that you have integral peace. If by integral peace we really mean that people are flourishing, people are happy, people are enjoying mutually harmonious relationships. So my question is, how can we develop that? Next slide, please. Now, I have some faith in another UN decade which has been developed, the UN decade of education for sustainable development. And I really, I'm deeply honored to be in Japan because we have this decade because of the initiative of the Japanese government in the 2002 conference on sustainability and development of Johannesburg. And Japan has been the major funder of this decade, which goes from the year 2005 to the year 2014. Also, it's coordinated by UNESCO, and I'm a member of one of the advisory groups with UNESCO for this decade. So I now have a little bit more faith in the concept of sustainable development. It's not that I've given up on culture of peace as a concept, but I think it's been sequestered by the security paradigm. And so my question is now, is it possible that perhaps the notion of development and the questioning, this dynamic, more positive approach to what is development? And we're not just talking about development here necessarily for the underdeveloped countries, but I think the whole question is, what is the development of the human potential everywhere? What does it mean for different kinds of economies and societies? But particularly bringing in much more strongly the environmental sustainability dimension. In the former UN Culture of Peace Action Plan, there were eight basic points. The eighth was sustainable economic development. So what we're doing here in this new decade is bringing to the fore the environmental sustainability issues. And as we were saying yesterday, I think this is tremendously important because I do think we are right now facing critical survival issues. The relationship between the human species and the rest of the planet, the impact we've created is so tremendous. And even in our best analysis, we don't really have a complete understanding of these very complex interactions that are going on. And some people, as I would mention yesterday, like James Lovelock, believe that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, for example, the 1,500 scientists who were the co-winners of the Nobel Peace Prize with Al Gore, do not even take sufficiently into consideration the importance of the biotic community in the climate processes on the planet. The interaction of the atmosphere, what's going on in the oceans, in the earth, and so on. It's estimated that on the planet there are 150 million different species. Science has only studied approximately 10 million species. And we are destroying habitats of many of these species. Many of them are bacteria and fungi. And we're destroying living entities. We don't even know that they exist, much less do we know what critical functions they might be playing in the overall integrity of the Earth ecosystem. So this is a very deep kind of ignorance that we have, and we need, I think, to accelerate in our educational systems the knowledge of Earth science as a living systems and our human relationship in that, and that's hopefully will be one of the contributions of this new decade. Now, within the context of the decade, there's a document called the Earth Charter. The Earth Charter is an ethical document. You can find it in the website earthcharter.org or earthcharterinaction.org. It's considered to be the document that has had the broadest consultation of any contemporary document in the world. A call for such a document came already way back in 87 from the Brundtland Commission. I was honored to be part of the drafting of this document, and I've been very much involved and committed since the year 2000 when it was publicly announced to look at the educational implications of it. I don't have time, of course, to go into detail, but there are a few principles of the Charter that I want to point to you. First of all, it presents a very, very interesting, integral, and positive peace concept based on the self-realization of persons and communities oriented towards the principles of generosity in human harmony, joyful harmony. So this other side of the peace concept, I think you'll find it very clearly there. It also presents to us this idea that we live in a critical time period. We have choices, personal and collective choices. It has a very inspiring, I would say, integral peace concept, which literally says, recognize that peace is the integrity created by right relationships with oneself, other people, other cultures, other forms of life, and the whole of which all are a part. And I think we all, as humans, have this very strong need to have a meaningful existence, find a life mission, and to understand our relationship with this whole, this universe of which we all are part. And I think some cultures have expressed this historically in a very clear way. And that's one reason why I'm also so happy to be in Japan, because I'm fascinated by some of your deep traditions of harmony with nature and harmony in the human heart with one another. And I'm just hoping that this dimension of your heritage could become better known around the world. Next slide, please. Now, the Charter also talks about two principles. One, the principle of universal responsibility. And I see this as a complement to the 1948 Universal Declaration of Human Rights, importance of the universal community addressing the dignity of the rights of each person. But now we are in an era where we've developed a kind of notion of human being, of what it means to be a personhood or selfhood, which is basically competitive, egoistic. The capitalist globalized system makes us want to be compulsive people working very hard to produce and to consume, and we live in debt to buy things oftentimes we don't really need, and then we're not happy with each other, and ill health. It's a very crazy world we're in. Not everybody, thankfully, but I think that's the kind of culture that you find everywhere nowadays. So the idea here is that we all have a responsibility. That's one sense of universality. But also, we have now the knowledge that how the scope of our actions impinge on the whole fabric of the web of life on the planet. So the idea is that we are not just local and national citizens, but we are citizens of a human family, but also a greater community of life that has to learn to live integrally with the Earth system as a whole. So there's a quote here in the Earth Charter: everyone shares responsibility for the present and future well-being of the human family and the larger living world. You find a quote in here, and I think I'm just about ready to go into this slide, the DVD. I think that this consciousness of universal responsibility, we all have, all humans have it. You'll be seeing in a little while a group of youth living in a marginal urban community in San Jose, Costa Rica, with whom we worked, who live in chronic violence, all kinds of violence. I think sometimes studying the micro situations can be as revealing as trying to understand these very complex macro conflicts that we've been focusing on. So just bear in mind that this quote that very spontaneously came from one young man, 17 years old. He said, "The sun shines equally for all. Therefore, we should treat one another as equals." I've learned so much from that. I keep on reflecting on it. Next slide, please. Now, there's another principle that brings down to earth, makes it practical, the universal responsibility principle. This is the principle of differential responsibility. Basically, it says that affirm that with increased freedom, knowledge, and power comes increased responsibility to promote the common good. So real freedom in the planet is unevenly distributed. If we understand by freedom the external, let's say, dimension of freedom, the access to life choices, life goods, etc. Only 1 minute left? Okay. So the question is, how can we transmute these differences into what I would call generative power rather than power of dominance? Because usually the greater power, knowledge, and so on we have, we use for dominating. And there's a relationship between freedom and responsibility. But this approach to responsibility is really addressing not so much the ethical, but the capacity to respond approach to responsibility. So basically, what we're saying is we can develop a consensus of our common shared values and ethics and principles for living in a sustainable, democratic, peaceful world, but we have differential means. And also we're diverse in cultures. So how can we synergize positively? Next, please. And the view of human development is also very, I'd say, useful for consciousness, awareness, and education. The idea that it says we must realize that when basic needs have been met, human development is primarily about being more, not having more. So to ask the question, what does it mean to be? And I think this takes us beyond our personal individual selves. And this is where I think some of the Eastern ways of thinking and philosophies and religious traditions that really go deeply into this being mode has so much to offer to this international dialogue on what are cultures of peace and what can be perhaps an emerging global culture of peace, which I don't think will ever come dictated top-down from a UN program. It comes from the struggles and the dialogues of peoples around the world in a multicultural dialogue. Next. These are the four main principles of the Earth Charter. And it has three other chapters which develop these in detail, but basically it's respect Earth and life in all its diversity, care for the community of life with understanding, compassion, and love. This is the one that I really believe in deeply, that it has so much potential to liberate that positive side for peace building. Build democratic societies that are just, participatory, sustainable, and peaceful, and secure Earth's bounty and beauty for present and future generations. Next. Jeff. Well, I don't have time to go into this. This is, anyway, a model called Integral Model of Peace Education, which we've developed and have used, and it has all of these different dimensions in an orderly way. But basically, the idea is that peace is a whole balanced integral state of being. We have, you can't see it from the back maybe, but it has universal responsibility right in the core next to being peace and so on. But basically, there's three dimensions of human responsibility. Peace with ourselves. And that means being responsible to the privilege of our existence and to find the life mission that give our lives the greatest happiness and meaningfulness. We are responsible to one another. That's the other dimension. We are responsible together with nature. So next, Jeff. So I wanted to share with you an example of how many of these principles can be brought out in a non-formal educational setting, not by teaching people, but by creating enabling conditions where they can get deeply in touch with both sides, but both. What do people not want? What do they fear? But also getting deeply in touch with what do we really need and what do we really want? These are the fundamental existential questions that we've worked with. So do we have time to see the DVD, the 12-minute DVD, or not? Professor, do we have time?
Unfortunately, you spend most of your time.
Okay, then yeah. I'm so sorry.
I'm sorry for that.
Okay, so how much time do I actually have left then? None? Okay. Okay. Well, maybe some other occasion, lunch or something, you might be able to, those who wish. It's an interesting experience. It's a group of youth in this community in San Jose. They live in a very marginal way. But it demonstrates how people, oftentimes, you know, we think about these conflict areas or people living in the margins, and we underestimate the consciousness that they have, and which we all have, what it means to aspire to live in a wholesome, peaceful manner, where there is gender equity, where there really is value of the civic virtues and the public institutions and so on and so forth. Oftentimes we think we have to come and teach others you know, how do you build democracy? And I would say this is not the case. But anyway, that's a whole pedagogical aspect that we can talk about more. Thank you.
ありがとうございました。若干時間。
Thank you very much.